And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Or they're throttling back my internet already.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. I'm stumbling all over it because of the unexpected little complaint from Dean Haglund at the top of the show. I am Phil Lairness, your friend in podcasting, down under for a couple weeks longer, sitting all alone in an empty room, save one piece of artwork that he's staring at. This is Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hi, everybody. How are you? Listen to that echo chamber that used to be furnished. Yep.
Now, when we were doing our little test, you didn't move around like you just did. But so I'm going to ask you to remain perfectly still.
Jesus. Oh, my God. That's echoing that. There's one leather couch that we're trying to sell. Of course, nobody buys leather in Australia because none of the houses are insulated. So it's too cold to sit on leather 6 months of the year.
Okay. Let me point out to you, you're the one that explained to me that you're working off the built-in microphone on the laptop, right? So, yes, any sound that is there in the room, the laptop is going to amplify because it thinks incorrectly, good work, AI, that I want to hear that.
How about that jet flying overhead? You hearing that?
Oh, my God. I don't know whether we're doing a test right now or whether we're doing the show, but let's just continue. This is the penultimate episode of the Australian era of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. Yes, and if what I read is true, penultimate means next to last.
Wow, I did not know that. I thought it meant soon to be greatest. I don't know.
The greatest writing instrument ever. It's the penultimate. Which is not a bad sponsor for this show.
Hey, penultimate.
By the way, our actual sponsor, Empire State Gas, celebrated 50 years of existence this past week. So happy 50th to Empire State Gas. The largest independently owned gas station chain in the Northeast United States. Their gas is, of course, organically grown and good for the environment. Empire State Gas, from farm to pump, we've got great gas. Dean, how goes the bucket list? Have we crossed anything off the down under bucket list?
Well, let's see. There was the we finished a successful month of running a comedy club.
No more no more bucket list items about the hilarium. We established week that your bucket list is apparently two things and then hilarium written 12 times.
Well, it takes a lot of focus, that show. So anything else off the bucket list? Oh, my God.
All right. Here's what
I finished my jar of Vegemite. How about that?
Vegemite. You finally, is that's not the same jar that you had in LA, is it?
No. I bought one here, but it's lasted 3 years. So the timing was perfect. Got it first day I was here and just had a muffin, English muffin with Vegemite and emptied the jar.
Okay. Well, that's off the bucket list. All right. I am going to hit you with some questions then, because you are leaving in less than 2 weeks. With this, like I said, we'll do two more shows. But in case, I wanted to hit you with these questions this week, and then if anything else occurs to you that you want to mention next week, you can. But I'm curious. I'm curious. What will you miss most about Australia?
Well, this is the curious thing. We're asking ourselves that as we walk around and going, is it going to be the big things, the lovely weather, the, you know, fun abbreviations of things like mosquitoes are mozzies and avocados are avos? Or are we going to miss, you know, the things that all the tourists love, the water, the beaches, the bridges, the scenery? We're not sure. And I think it's going to come up and surprise us once we get smacked with culture shock to go, oh, yeah, you know, it was really handy, those bananas that we always ate and we can't get them anymore. So we have no definite list, but I know the coffee will be missed because they get this Indonesian brand that isn't exported anywhere else in the world. It's quite delicious.
I follow Kyle MacLachlan. Of course, Agent Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks. I follow him on Instagram, and this guy really knows how to use Instagram. I mean, he's might be the best at it I've ever seen. But yesterday morning, you know, he woke up, first thing out of bed, he posts GIF of himself as Agent Cooper from the original Twin Peaks series, just drinking coffee, okay? But the caption... The caption alone, I think, is what earned 8,000 likes in the first 7 minutes of this thing being posted. It was this. This is what he wrote. He said, if you work hard enough, every day can be National Coffee Day. And that speaks to my heart, which is deep inside my body and is ordinarily my least vulnerable spot. All right. Let me ask you then this, Dean Hagland.
Okay.
I'm curious, what if somebody asked you, and I guess I am asking you so that somebody would be me, what are your favorite places that you've been in Australia? This can be in Sydney or elsewhere.
Wow. That is fantastic. There's so many things. Let's start with the city itself and some of my favorite places here, including, you know, the tourists, they all see the parks, the bridge, the opera house. Those are all lovely. But when you get out to Newtown and Strathmore and Lewisham and all of these neighborhoods, there are delightful little parks and cafes. I don't know if I I say one.
So first of all, those neighborhoods, those you love just, I guess, strolling through those neighborhoods.
Absolutely. And sketching, you see on my Instagram, many an image from the neighborhood buildings and architecture that's so unique here.
Well, might that be one of the things that you'll miss the most is the architecture that's so unique?
Absolutely. The architecture is so unique. And how about the walkability of all of these neighborhoods? They're all interconnected. While the sidewalks may be narrow, they are plentiful. So that is fantastic. And, you know, there's all these quirky little cafes. There's this place open that used to be lawn bowling, and they've taken up all the lawn and they've planted vegetables that they then harvest and serve in the restaurant so that the entire restaurant is so farm to table that you can see the farm. You're eating amongst the farm, basically.
How about a few? Why not plug a few places? Are there any particular restaurants or bars or cafes that you want to give a plug to that come to the top of your mind?
Well, if you find yourself in the Newtown area, drop in and say hello to my friends at Stinking Bishop, the almost 70 different varieties of cheese and 30 different varieties of wine. It's almost an ongoing wine and cheese party every night at Stinking Bishop on Enmore Road. Where else do I like? Oh, you know, the most Instagram dessert on Instagram is the watermelon strawberry cake at Black Star Pastry right on Australia Street. They have tour buses come by and everybody marches in to get a big thick slab of strawberry watermelon layered shortcake. And man, is that delicious. You would think a slice of watermelon would be too juicy, but they somehow get it at a perfect ripeness so that the strawberries and watermelon layered in there. Oh, that's a good one. Where else? Are we doing a podcast or am I just salivating?
Why not? I love it. Why not? People, I think, would love to hear. If there's more that you're passionate about, why not plug them?
Oh, well, if you also a very difficult place to find is the motorcycle workshop member only motorcycle garage / restaurant coffee bar called The Rising Sun. And it is a members, you rent a bay, you work on your motorcycle because so many places in and around the Newtown area don't have garages. And so you can rent for $30 an hour a bay. And then to the fundus, they open this coffee shop restaurant serving a unique Australian Korean fusion menu that is spectacular. The Rising Sun, I go all the time. Free Wi-Fi as well.
Maybe you could go there now while we're recording our podcast so that we actually have Wi-Fi. No?
Well, I did cancel our service. I said I needed it for this podcast, but if it cuts out in the middle of recording.
How were you going to do next week's podcast?
Oh, I'm going to be in a hotel. We got to be out of here because the landlord has already some tenants coming in. So we basically are...
Your lease. Everything must go.
Everything must go. And we are actually going to live in a hotel, a corporate hotel, for the last 6 days of our days in Australia.
Well, I was thinking maybe this will give you an opportunity during the week. Maybe you can jot down some names or ideas of places outside of Sydney, elsewhere in Australia, where you've been. I was curious, and this sounds like a backhanded compliment, but it's not. I mean, one of the reasons I love New York is it is a great gateway for me to Europe, right? 5 hours is not a long flight. And whereas, 10 hours from LA, that's a long flight. I mean, you're blowing a whole day and maybe even a night and part of the next day because you're adjusting to the time and everything. But I'm curious about that aspect, about Australia being a gateway to parts of the world that you might not have been able to explore otherwise.
Well, that's true. I mean, we would never have gone to Cambodia or some other places around there. And they say that when you're in Los Angeles, 2 hours drive south, and suddenly you're in a completely different country, different culture, different foods, different language. You drive 2 hours north, completely different food, completely different culture, same language, much colder. So you have these differentials. Whereas if you drive 2 hours in any direction from Sydney, you're in Australia. You're still in Australia. In fact, you could drive 4 days in any direction and you'd still be in Australia because you can't drive off the island except to Tasmania, which is an $800 ferry ride. And when you get to Tasmania, it's similar to Australia. So the point is that this is why a lot of Australians go to Bali for their vacation time, a place I haven't been to. But, having gone to Kuala Lumpur and Bangladesh and Cambodia, all of those places are places I probably wouldn't have gone to were it not for being here.
How long have you lived there again now? Has it been like two and a half years? 3 years?
No, three plus years.
Three plus years. Okay. And if you were, let's say, to have to move down to that hemisphere again for 3 years, if you knew that it was a finite amount of time,
Right.
Would you pick Sydney? Would you pick another part of Australia? Would you pick New Zealand? What do you think?
Well, that's a great question. You know, a comedian said to me, he said, you know, of the three cities, you know, Perth on the far side, Perth is what the rest of the world thinks Australia is like. It's pristine, beautiful. There's a waterfront, ocean. And then Melbourne is what Australians want the world to think they're like. Cultured, fun, lots of theater, nicely laid out. And then Sydney is actually what Australians are like. Drunk, fighting, noisy, money grubbing, you know, that kind of thing. So if I were to do it another time, I think maybe Melbourne. It has a little more, not more culture, but it has a variety of, there's more comedy clubs for sure and improv places and that sort of thing. So Melbourne's lovely. Of course, Brisbane, you cannot beat for the weather. The farther north you get, the more warmer and temperate it is up there. So Brisbane is kind of into the next climate zone part of Australia. And, you know, would I go? Yeah, would I go? But I would come back to Sydney for sure. Because, you know, it's fantastic here as well.
I'm so intrigued by that, what you just laid out about the three cities. One, what the world thinks of us. Two, what we want the world to think of us. And three, what we really are. I'm trying to figure out, like, America, because we're so divided right now that questions two and three are, at least question two is really difficult. What do we want the world to think of us as? So I feel like maybe the world thinks of us as either Los Angeles or New York. But America, if we had to pick a city, a consensus.
Well, I don't think we would. I think we'd pick Disneyland. Like, to me,
America wants people, again, divided country that we live in, wants the world to think of. I think we could build a consensus around, like, Dallas, because Dallas has culture, but Dallas is still red MAGA America. And
I guess, but don't you think Walt Disney embodied America, the ideal, so much, and then he built outwards an extension of his own sensibility?
He did, but I don't know if America feels that way, because question three, what city? But by the way, Disneyland's not a city. I would like to point that out to you. And the thing was, the three cities was what you laid out. But the answer to three is what I'm getting at here, which is the city that best represents us is Fresno. So anyway,
oh my God.
More to explore on this in the future. But yeah, maybe jot down some of the places outside Sydney that you're going to miss, or that you wish people would get the chance to visit. And we'll talk about it next week. Another thing we're going to talk about next week is a live event of the week that I'm participating in tonight. That's why we're recording a little bit early. Today is the celebration across the city. On literally every street, it is a citywide celebration of the 100th anniversary of the LA Philharmonic today. There are street performances involving the LA Phil marching through LA all the way from downtown to the Hollywood Bowl, where tonight they will put on their 100th anniversary performance. And I'll be there in swanky terrace seats down front, Dean Haglund.
Look at you. Who's connected to the mayor?
You know, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, founded by a breakfast clubber, don't you know? Ellie Beheimer, we so are fond of saying on my podcast, the Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the Air, better known as Lou. Okay, so that's all next week's show, but we have an email from a loyal listener pertaining to our conversation of last week about the role of editing in creating or altering actors' performances.
Very good. Let's hear it.
It begins. Hi.
Hi. That's us. Hi to us.
Doubtless, I'm last in a long, nerdish queue of cinema sticklers to mention that Eisenstein's teacher, Lev Kuleshov, published the alleged results of his experiments in Montage. I attributed them to Eisenstein because, again, Eisenstein, yes. That's the name everyone knows, and that's the easiest reference point. But it was Lev Kuleshov who claimed that the juxtaposition of two shots, one always the same, of the effectless face of a famous actor, the second, a bowl of soup, of a woman in a coffin, a woman on a couch, aroused in the audience the belief that the character played by the famous actor was A, hungry, B, sad, and then C, in turn, amorous, even though it was the same effectless shot.
Right.
Regrettably, as far as I know, the original footage does not exist. Some speculate it may never have existed. My favorite, this is the listener continues, my favorite teaching example is from Hitchcock, an outspoken believer in the Kuleshov effect. I used the exterior shot from Vertigo at the Palace of Fine Arts, in which Judy and Scotty walk unspeaking past a young couple embracing and kissing on the lawn. I play silent. The sequence cuts from Judy and Scotty to the couple and back. To be fair, Kim Novak and James Stewart are acting. When I ask my students what the characters want, they always say that Novak wishes Stewart, Judy wishes Scotty, would kiss her. For what it's worth, Eisenstein rejected Kuleshov's theory of montage strenuously and did employ a more elaborate theory of editing. But he was a liar if he ever claimed he didn't include the Kuleshov effect in his bag of tricks. It's all over Potemkin.
Absolutely all over Potemkin.
Thank you for indulging my pedantry. Ham and eggs forever, Robert. And this is from a fellow Breakfast Clubber, a film professor, and a Jacob Javits fellow, as I like to sing at the club every so often, for he's a Jacob Javits fellow, for he's a Jacob. And that's Mr. Robert Nichols, the Right Honorable Robert Nichols. What an excellent email.
That's an excellent email, and quite thought-provoking, too, because, yes, the editing more elaborate than the straight linear face emotion, object of emotion, sine, cosine, signage, you know, that whole arts in context. Dare I bring up my arts in context classes from my university days? But yeah, you think about Battleship Potemkin and the even just the three edits of the statue of the lion rising, giving it an animated rise to revolution of the stone lion. That, to me, is even a more elaborate editing montage sequence than the Kuleshov effect.
You know, it's one of the reasons when I was younger especially, I tried to eschew coverage as much as possible in favor of master shots. Love a master shot. And it's one of the things that I realized early on was it's because coverage is fascist. It directs it directs the audience's attention, and it commands how the audience will feel. Whereas master shots are uncomfortable for an audience, increasingly so in an era where, you know, cutting became so rapid in the 90s and the 2000s. Now, you know, master shots have, even on television, have started to reemerge. But for a long time, they made audiences really uncomfortable. One, because they felt slow. But what does that mean? Why would that make them so uncomfortable? It's because it puts the audience in the unusual position of having to decide for themselves not only what they want to see, but how to feel about what they're seeing. And that
Citizen Kane all over, isn't it? I mean, they had in a maximum depth of field. They even built ceilings on all the film sets so that you had a complete immersion in the master shot and had to decide amongst yourselves where to look in the whole mise-en-scene.
Well, and what an interesting idea, because he's depicting, Wells is depicting a story about a man who wanted to be the great friend of the people, a populist of the little man who was, in fact, a tin-plated dictator, a fascist.
Exactly.
And, oh my God, isn't that the story of America, and isn't that the story of America today? And and every filmmaker has that conflict within them. You know, I do what I do for the people, and I'm going to dictate how they feel about the story that I'm telling, right? So that was why I always felt, no, a master, it's democratic. And yet, right, interestingly enough, as I get older, I'm less interested in that, the democracy of the master shot, because I've already been there and done that. And now I'm trying to incorporate editing technique that removes as much as possible, however, the invocation of a particular reaction on the part of an audience. I want to create, I want to use editing to create wildly different reactions within the same audience.
Right. Well, remember, that is our experience of watching Caché, the French film.
Although but that was heavy masters. And what I'm saying is, I want to do the same, but not using masters, but using editorial technique. And I think we've accomplished it, certainly, in The Lady Killers. So,
wow. Interesting.
Fantastic email. Thank you for your scholarly, academic nerdishness, Robert Nichols. I mean, Hitchcock, Kuleshov, Eisenstein, three names that I enjoy saying. You know, before I let you leave Australia, and I don't know why has to happen before then, but, you know, we went through this last month, especially, a lot of press about the 25th anniversary of The X-Files. And, of course, this celebration will continue throughout this year and early 2019, as we celebrate the 25th anniversary of the first season of The X-Files. And I don't know if I've ever asked you this, and I haven't had to because you've been asked at conventions, and you always have witty responses to it. But looking back, and you're not being asked to compile and submit a list. So what I'm intrigued by about this is it will be just, it might even surprise you which ones stand out the most when I ask this, but do you have any favorite episodes?
Well, you know, my go-to always has been the episode Humbug with Jim Rose's Freak Circus, the family of freaks living in a Florida commune that Mulder and Scully go investigate. And, you know, Enigma, who is the tattooed fella. And because I had seen Jim Rose's circus at the town pump, the pub in Gastown, Vancouver, long gone now. It was called the town pump. And they came to do one of their rock and roll magic freak shows that were revived in the 90s. And so it was cool to see them on that episode of Humbug. So that one always for me was a standout just because it was a perfect intersection of the time, of those guys, of the show, of popular culture.
But also, how about some of the other things that The X-Files was, which was really a place on television where some character actors got to do some of their finest work. How about Vincent Schiavelli in that episode?
Yeah.
I mean, that heartbreaking, both scary and weird and heartbreaking, which, you know, was what Vincent Schiavelli was in spades, but rarely did he get such a great opportunity. He might have a scene here or there in films, but, I mean, he's in some very strange ways, he's the heart of that episode. The other thing is a conversation really emerges in that episode, I think, that it runs throughout the most recent season 11, which is this idea of conspiracy theories as a con.
Right. Right. That the conspiracy theory is the elaborate smokescreen to the thing. I guess that's the theme that came in there, isn't it? Huh.
So it's fascinating. That's a great episode and some of my favorite moments when I think about the X-Files being funny. And you talk about editing. Oh my God. There is an episode where, there's a moment in there where I think the guy you're talking about is talking about how awful the future is going to be, where all diversity is kind of weeded out. And like the oddities, the freaks are gone, and the whole future looks like that. And he points, and we cut to this long shot of Mulder, like in a Mervyn's mail catalog ad pose.
Right.
And I always thought that's a shot the editors found.
Oh, you don't think that was set up?
I don't
that
know.
Wasn't scripted?
I mean, I know the gag was cut to a shot of Mulder, but I feel like, you know, the editors had a field day going, is there any moments when Duchovny doesn't know the camera's on him?
Right.
But anyway, any other favorite episodes?
Oh, let's see. There's so many, isn't there? The ones we were in, of course, loved Unusual Suspects. That was the first origin story of the Lone Gunman and came about actually because of a scheduling problem with David Duchovny having to do reshoots on his movie and Jillian stuck in London for a few more days working on something. So we had to start production without the two leads. And Frank said they were all sitting around going, well, who else have we got? They went, well, let's do the gunman's origin story. And they went, oh, what a great idea. And so based on that, we were all, we managed to get an episode in. And then at the final day, both Mulder and Scully show up and are cut in through the whole episode.
But so, was it difficult to be, because that's the episode where, of course, Richard Belzer, recreates his role that originated on Homicide, which of course was on the air at that time, a role he would play on later series. But at that time, the original show Homicide on a different network was airing. Was it difficult to arrange such a crossover?
Apparently it wasn't. It was, I guess, at the height of the popularity of the series itself. So according to everyone, it was a call. Richard said he just got a call from an agent going, hey, you want? Of course you want to do the X-Files, right? And he goes, absolutely. Like the two of them were in agreement that who would turn that down? And the network negotiation seemed to be almost non-existent, just saying we'd like Richard Belzer to play his character on our show. And there he was.
Hey, do you have any other than your own? Do you have a favorite character or recurring character in the X-Files?
I thought Nick Lee playing Agent Krychek was always interesting. The way Nick did it, you know, bringing in this kind of level of aloofness, yet coolness, and then an intensity. It was really an interesting mix. I always thought Nick was fantastic as Agent Krychek. So I think that's probably one of my favorites, just in terms of the subtle, multi-leveled nuance he brought to it.
When you watch, because you will stream and binge episodes of TV shows that are produced literally around the world. And
yes.
And we know from having met people around the world that the X-Files had a footprint everywhere.
Right.
I'm curious, do you catch yourself watching recent or modern series and ever saying to yourself, wow, that's a direct or was directly influenced in some way by the X-Files. That's a lasting impact right there. That's you know, part of the X-Files legacy. Are you aware of that when you watch contemporary television?
Yeah, every now and then, you know, to see a any show with a super nerdy forensic, if it's a police procedural or a computer hacker, I'm going, oh, yeah, I did that 20 years ago.
Yeah, but I don't mean like, your influence. I mean the influence of the X-Files as a whole.
Of course. Absolutely. You see it from top to bottom, from long arc storytelling to way deeper lighting. You know, you think about lighting of TV shows before the X-Files, and then suddenly they were going to a 5-to-1 ratio. They were knocking it back so that it was plenty, you know, 3/4 of the screen in darkness, for crying out loud. You never saw that in television before the X-Files. You think about just moments, the just pacing and tone, how much the X-Files changed the tone of television from that point onwards, so that you could have all of these, particularly BBC, you know, you think about all their darker things like Luther what's the other one I'm thinking about? But how the tone sort of slowed down and filled out more cinematically, looking at television, as opposed to just churning it out like a Murder, She Wrote.
I've been struck, you know, one of my favorite things, and we've talked about this before, was, you know, the working relationship between a man and a woman, Mulder and Scully, and both how they encouraged the best in each other and had little or no judgment. Not that they lacked annoyance with each other. They would get annoyed with each other, but they didn't have judgment towards each other about the parts, the unique parts of each other that were different from themselves, or that even were the parts that annoyed them. They didn't have judgment about each other, and that made this working relationship turning into a personal relationship, friendship, you know, really interesting and unique, I thought. And I was struck by this again this week when realizing I think that relationship has affected the depictions of male woman working relationships throughout television. And to wit, I saw two shows this week, wildly different, completely different genres. But one was Better Call Saul, the most recent episode of Better Call Saul, which is winding down its fourth season. And of course, this is created by Vince Gilligan. But so it has direct lineage to the X-Files. But on Better Call Saul, we're one of the things that we're following is the relationship romantically between Bob Odenkirk's Jimmy McGill, who is becoming Saul Goodman this season, and Rhea Seehorn, who plays Kim Wexler, another attorney. But they also are working together on cases. And it's fascinating because they both work to bring out the best in each other, but not necessarily the best as defined by society's idea of morality and ethics. No, the best in terms of what do you do the best that fills you with most a sense of being alive, even if that is counter to the ethos of our profession, our society. And and it's this interesting dance because romantically they seem to feel like they should be encouraging the quote-unquote best as defined by ethos and society. But professionally, they're drawn to each other because they have fun with what each other does best, especially when that's outside the pale. But the point is, there's never any judgment. So right when you think, okay, the romantic relationship is doomed here, it actually reignites because they have no judgment towards each other.
Now that's fascinating, right? Because so much not just of writing, but of television, of trying to compress and telegraph and drive your narrative comes from assuming judgment of, you know, a black and white bad character, good guy, bad guy. Like all of these things on lazy writing are painted with a wide brush.
It makes the show, and when I said I think it has moved beyond, in a way, Breaking Bad, one of the ways it's moved beyond it is because we were always aware, even when we were rooting for Walter White on Breaking Bad, we were aware that he was the cancer within this family.
Right.
And yes. He was unhealthy to his family. And what's fascinating is every time we think we've gotten to that point with Jimmy McGill, who's becoming Saul, we go, well, wait a minute. He might actually be breathing life into the people around him through his nefarious activities. It's far more complex.
Isn't that fascinating?
The other show that I wanted to hit you with, and I know it's a show you like, and suddenly I'm watching these working relationships, and I'm going, damn, if this is not also influenced in some way. And that's The Good Place, where you have especially the character, the main character played by Kristen Bell, and you have Chidi, who are working together as kind of this ethical pair, trying to make each other better by making her better. And in some of the permutations, they have a romantic relationship. In some, they are barely friends. But in all of them, they work together. They get aggravated with each other. They are annoyed by each other, but they never judge each other, and they do bring out uniquely the best in each other.
Well, see, this may be a lesson for everyone. Isn't that funny that while we're trying to select a judge, we have lessons about how not to judge, how to remove judgment and judgment values, right? What values do we use to judge people by? And are those values in line with your morality? So, you know, I find this all fascinating, how that's reflecting back and forth in our culture and in our times.
Not surprisingly, I could fill a whole show with thoughts about the circus going on, and I'm going to stay away from it for now. I'm going to save my comments for a little while.
Till the circus is over. Nobody comments on the lion tamer while he's taming the lion.
Yeah, well,
you save that afterwards.
Hey, I do want to do, while we have some time, I do want to revisit a lawsuit of the week. So, Garrett Watley, if you please.
Take it.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
We have checked in a couple times on the lawsuit between CBS and Paramount and Sherry Redstone, who owns both of them through her company, of course, and the attempt that she has had to remerge them. CBS has fought this tooth and nail. And of course, the biggest obstacle at CBS was their president and CEO, Les Moonves, who is now out at CBS, right? And I mean, I guess this is a reference to the Supreme Court, nomination battle involving Brett Kavanaugh, and people wanting to see these, accusations by women who've come forward so long after the supposed events as very suspicious, as a con job being put on by the Democrats, whereas there's nothing unusual about women not wanting to come forward. And and one of the reasons they don't want to come forward is the person they're coming forward against might end up being a Supreme Court justice. And you've now offended one of the most powerful people in the world. So this is one of the reasons that it's tough for women to come forward. But it's not surprising and not suspicious that these claims come forward In the wake of, in this case, a nomination process, in the case of Les Moonves, as we talked about, a major lawsuit. Because for the first time, money and resources are being spent to turn over every leaf trying to find opposition research. And that is when people who have complaints, perhaps that they have sat on, get discovered and exposed and, in some cases, used, exploited, right?
Right.
So we've talked about that. It didn't make these women who came forward against Les Moonves not credible because of the timing of it. No, the timing made sense because only now are people putting the money and the effort into researching his past.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So he's out. And so one of the big opponents of the merger is gone. The merger has officially been, the discussion of the merger to settle this lawsuit has officially been on hold for 2 years, and Sherry Redstone has guaranteed that she will seriously consider any other merger or acquisition offer for CBS that comes forward. Because this apparently was the issue. CBS, which is a tiny entertainment property. So odd to think that, right? I mean, it's
the
Tiffany Network, the oldest, most, prestigious television network, radio network before it in the world is tiny. And it wants to be bought. Everybody at CBS wants to be acquired by a major player. And the problem is Paramount is not a major player. Paramount has no money. Paramount is almost a tiny player itself.
And, a shingle.
And that's why that merger makes a lot of sense. People in charge of a re-merged Paramount and CBS, if they're creative, oh man, they could have an enterprise, if you'll pardon the expression, because obviously we'll get to Trek in a minute, but that could really navigate the changing technological entertainment landscape in some exciting ways that I don't think you could do with a bigger company. But CBS wants to partner with a major, major player. So that'll be interesting to see what plays out. They don't want to merge.
Yeah.
They don't want to merge with someone small. They want to be bought by a big fish.
Right. And don't we all? I mean, ultimately, if somebody came to buy this podcast, would you not sell it in a heartbeat?
Well, I don't know if that's the...
analogy you're looking for?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think you are
literally comparing apples to assholes right now. And I
But you said the one key word, and that is creative thinking. And ultimately these buyouts are not creative thinking. They are seemingly washing your hands of responsibility, or perhaps there's something leaky in the foundation. And you're trying to sell that house on the market before anybody notices. So I'm always suspicious. You think about Warner Brothers buying of what was it? Online America? America Online, AOL, for billions of dollars, and then realizing, wait a sec, they're just a couple of servers and two nerds in a room. The American Online wasn't any sort of property that required that kind of capital.
Well, the fourth Trek movie starring Chris Pine, which was going to co-star Chris Hemsworth as Kirk's dad, a role he created in the first Star Trek directed by J.J. Abrams, that has been put on hold. It was script was ready. It was supposed to go into production in early 2019. Still could. This is not the Quentin Tarantino developed Trek film, which would be down the line, but. It's been put on hold because Pine and Hemsworth have walked away. From what I can gather, they were promised a certain salary, and Paramount went back on those salary numbers.
Office.
And
yeah.
have offered less. And one of the reasons is because Paramount has lost a financial partner and has not been able to replace that partner, so they literally can't afford to pay what they could for the film before. That's the trouble that Paramount is in.
Wow.
I figure that will work itself out. We'll probably have this fourth film. It will be the film as rumored about the two of them. But the bigger question is, how viable is it to continue to maintain the franchise completely separate on the big screen versus the small screen without any, and here's that dreadful corporate word. Any synergy between the two?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think everybody looks at the Marvel Universe now as the model that the interlockingness of the narratives from your TV to your feature films, and even to now the comic books themselves, all of them have a single sort of throughput that you can put together like a jigsaw. And if Star Trek doesn't start thinking of their Federation universe as a bit more holistically, let's not say synergistically, but maybe just holistically, then perhaps there is some new creative thinking that is needed, as you put it.
I am curious, since we're talking about the small screen now all of a sudden, I'm curious about your familiarity with a writer and producer of both film and television, but especially TV, Greg Berlanti. Berlanti? I mean, I never watched, but I know of his work on the series Dawson's Creek, Brothers and Sisters.
Right.
He did Everwood, Political Animals, Riverdale. He writes for DC Comics. He is integral in the CW's Arrowverse.
Right.
In 2017, he set a record having 10 different live-action scripted television series planned to air in that very season. The record...
Wow.
The record was broken this year by someone who has 14 scripted live-action series planned to air within the current Holy season, and that person who broke the record was himself. But that's not a name that's really sticking out to you.
Well, it is. I mean, I've seen him credits. I did watch Riverdale. Only because I wanted to see how you take Archie Comics and turn it darker and turn it into a Dawson's Creek, basically a dark version of Dawson's Creek, and how Jughead's reimagined as a gang member who is thoughtful in his journal writing, bringing the intrigue and nefariousness of Riverdale, of all things, into the spotlight. But yeah. There's a commonality for sure in Arrow to Riverdale to all of his writing, and it is very much a emotional core, but a perplexed emotional core of not a coming of age, but of a youthful rage, I would say, that he sort of tapped into. And and you could sort of feel it at timing again. So I could see how he can get 14 different shows out of that kind of continual tumultuous fodder that one can write from. I just can't imagine how many words per minute that guy is typing. Or is he doing it all voice, dragon voice? Is he just improvising amongst themselves to get these scripts out in time? That seems incredible.
Yeah, I don't know. And I will never find out. Because here's the thing. I didn't know who he was. And I have not ever seen a single hour of television that he is responsible for.
And I don't think he would. Yeah.
But I looked him up because I watched a movie this week called Love, Simon. Have you heard of this?
Yes.
I mean, I vaguely had heard of it, and I knew that it seemed like this kind of indie coming-of-age love story with a gay theme to it, and so I decided to check it out. Shocked to realize that it's the 14th biggest teen romance film of all time, the third biggest at the box office for 20th Century Fox, behind Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet with Leo DiCaprio and The Fault in Our Stars with Shailene Woodley. So this was a big box office hit. And it's notable because it's the first film by a major Hollywood studio to focus on a teen romance between gay characters. The first.
Wow.
The first studio film. So it is groundbreaking. Same year, interestingly enough, that we have, you know, a rather groundbreaking romantic comedy in that Crazy Rich Asians. So diversity is very much the word of the day. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to tell you that this this romantic teen comedy drama film had me sobbing like a baby during parts of it. I was totally a sucker for it. And, you know, I'm not Mr. Coming of Age story and I'm not Mr. Teen Romance story, but just the beauty of having a film, even though it is utterly a clean fantasy, you know, and I don't mean clean versus racy or, you know, something like that. I mean, it's everything's neat. Everything's very facile. But having such a neat, clean fantasy of what it is like to be able to come out to your family and your friends and find love, I think is a noble endeavor, especially for the first studio film, because why not? There's plenty of stories that talk about how dark and ugly and painful it can be. And there's moments of pain in this movie, obviously, and fear and shame. But it's nice to have one story at least that says, hey, maybe it can work out great to encourage people to, as this character learns to do, really not to come out so much as to exhale and to stop holding the best parts of himself secretive and hostage. Because that at its heart is what the film is about. But anyway, I bring up this Greg Berlanti because he directed it. And he did not write it. The writers, the script is pretty darn perfectly constructed. There are way too many. It's perfectly constructed. It's nice writing. It's based on the novel Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda by Becky Albertalli. There's a wonderful sequence in the film, a montage of what would it be like if heterosexual people had to come out to their parents. But it's written, the script was written by Isaac Apteker and Elizabeth Berger. So Greg Berlanti, this prolific television writer and producer, did not write this. He directed it. And as soon as I started watching this movie, the first 10 minutes, I kept saying to myself, dear God, as a movie director, whoever this director is, as a movie director, he really seems like a TV writer.
That's fascinating. What gave it away?
Well, part of it is how, first of all, how clean and neat everything is, how peppy every performance has to be.
Right.
I mean, by God, even teenagers playing reluctant and recalcitrant are doing it in a really peppy fashion. It's very high energy. Bring the energy, everybody. And so there's nothing grounding it in any kind of verisimilitude at all. That's a criticism that I have for it. However, again, it does cast a pretty nifty spell that works that might not have been possible without those performances. But I'm just, you asked me why it seemed, why I could tell who the director was without knowing a thing about him. That was a big piece of it, was these peppy performances. And the way that these high energy performances really pushed the energy level enabled you to see the writing. It wasn't that the writing was bad. It was that I could see it. I literally could see the pages of writing. The way that every moment at the end of scenes would be turned into a comedic ski jump so that we could launch into the next scene. You know, there are ways when, even if it's written like that, right? There are ways that directors will encourage an actor to find something truthful in those moments.
Right. Or underplay,
exactly.
as it were.
Exactly.
To counteract. Well, this is interesting. Now, this is a question then, as a director, has he so ingrained writing so much television that he unaware, or is he doing that because that sells television, so it should sell movies?
Well, and I don't know. I mean, the story ultimately works. I'm at home watching it, and I'm affected by it. It got good box office. One of the reasons it got good box office, it should be noted, because this is a pretty fascinating story. Right after the film's release, and it got pretty good reviews, 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is excellent, 72% on Metacritic. So it's not like people were saying that this is a masterpiece. But right after its release, many celebrities, including the film's co-star Jennifer Garner, but also many people who had nothing to do with the movie, Kristen Bell, Neil Patrick Harris, Matt Bomer, on and on, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, many, many actors and celebrities bought out theaters offering free screenings of the film because they believed it conveyed an important message. And this really helped the word of mouth. So that's a great story. But back to your question, and also kind of apropos of our discussion about synergy versus a holistic approach. The question is, at a time when people are going to watch whatever movie or TV show, however they want to watch it.
Right.
Does it matter anymore if movies seem like movies or if movies seem like TV shows? Or
That's a great question. Because, you know, I just watched Happy! Exclamation mark. Patton Oswalt as the imaginary friend, a unicorn to the drunk police officer. I don't know if you've seen this. 10-part series based on a graphic novel. However, I binge watched it all. I just watched a 10-hour movie. That's all. That's what it felt like. And I was working away in the background. But basically, instead of a 2-hour movie, it was a 10-hour movie. Lots of, it was fluffed, packed with some padding here and there for sure. But I would swear it was a feature film, not a TV series, even though it was in 10 parts.
It's I, much to your dismay, on a variety of levels, you'll remember one of my top two, I think, maybe it was number one film of last year was Twin Peaks: The Return. That was on my top 10 movies list, and I was not alone in that. It was the best movie of the year. Just because it was released to Showtime and not to theaters, well, that's shame on theaters and shame on all of us. I don't know. It's a scary question because I don't think, I mean, I don't know what you do. The genie is out of the bottle, and people are going to watch whatever they want to watch, however they want to watch it, and that's fine.
Right.
There are formats, though, in which I think certain stories play best, and you have to take an approach, I think, as a director, that ignores this idea of, oh, what will play best on the most possible formats.
Right.
And that,
right,
to me, is getting back to this idea of how do I depict the world as the character sees it with an authentic understanding of who this character is. And then what's the format that I see this being primarily distributed through? It's a really tricky thing, but I have found that it is very hard for showrunners who then move into movie directing to make that move. It's not that you can't direct for TV and then direct big screen movies, but it's these showrunners Chris Carter, for example, right?
Yeah.
John Wells of ER does the big screen version of August Osage County, a great play. And you think, oh, man, if it's not done by someone masterful like Robert Altman or perhaps P.T. Anderson, the risk is this is going to come off like a filmed play. Instead, it comes off like a film TV episode. And that's the thing is showrunners have a really hard time. I can't think of any showrunners off the top of my head. Maybe I'll research it. Who actually make interesting movie directors.
That's fascinating. Well, because also show running, you are traffic cop and whip cracker at the same time. You got to bring that ship in under 10 to 8 days in budget. You know, there's a lot more going on in your head than camera placement and creative acting work. So I could see those muscles, not just muscles, those ligaments, those sinews tightening so much as a showrunner that it's hard then to let that go instantly when you're in on the film set.
I don't know how we have gone through 3 years of a show in Australia without referring to ourselves by the character names Traffic Cop and Whipcracker. Because that's so good. The continuing adventures of Traffic Cop and Whipcracker. We can battle over which one of us is which, or let the listeners decide which one is which and explain why. God. In fact, write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Let us know which one of us is Traffic Cop and which one is Whipcracker. And let us know by next week, if you can, when we do our final ever show of our Australian era. Until then, you can find every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. We are way over time, Dean Haglund. So until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund.
No intercontinental LA to Australia.
Belated spoiler alert.